great pleasure to introduce Dan Eric Nielsen as our seminar speaker today. And Dan received his PhD at Lund University. He's actually trained both as a biophysicist as well as a biologist. And after completing his graduate work, he went on to Australia National University in Canberra, where he worked with Adrian Horridge and Michael Land on optics and vision. He was only in his postdoc for a year when he was offered a position at University of Lund, and so he returned back there and started his own group and began his studies in his lab on optics as well as the evolution of vision. And in 1995, Dan accepted the position as chair of the zoology department at the university. And he then made that, he spearheaded that in becoming a much larger biology department, where he serves as the director of the Lund Vision Group. Dan is a leader in our understanding of optics as well as our understanding of the evolution of vision. He's written numerous review articles and books on the topic of the evolution of vision, and we're really fortunate to have him here as part of the NTP subgroup on the evolution of vision. And so today Dan's going to talk to us about animal vision from jellyfish to people. So,
Thank you, that's a nice introduction. It's really my pleasure to be here. It's the first time I'm in this part of the States. Excited about that. I'm going to talk about animal vision, it says, from jellyfish to man. The reason I sort of picked that title is that I'm really going to talk about a lot of different animals, and the reason for that is that I'm interested in the evolution of vision. If you want to study the evolution of vision at a broad scale and really ask the questions how eyes originated in the first place, you can't just study a small group of animals. You really have to compare very different animals, and that's what I've been doing over a large number of years. So, of course, the evolution of vision, it has been studied for almost a century. People have concentrated on comparing eye morphology in all sorts of different animals and tried to make hypotheses about how eyes evolved. And then some, say, 20, 30 years ago, so at least 20 years ago, people started to investigate the underlying genetics behind it, and that solved a number of questions, but certainly not everything. But I think what you really have to understand is that evolution is a matter of variation, which is on the genetics level, and selection, which is not on the genetics level primarily, not even on the organ level, not on eyes and brains. It's really on fitness, and fitness is caused by visually guided behavior. So if animals can do better behavior, that certainly selects for different eye structures, because different behaviors put different requirements on the eyes or structures.
A loud speaker.
Pardon?
A loud speaker.
See if you can put the microphone.
I'll try to put the microphone higher up. Yeah. See if that works. How about that? Is that better? Yeah. So I've been asking questions about how, not really how eyes evolved, that's what I want to know, but I've started to studying how the visually guided behaviors have evolved, to try to work out which were the first visually guided behaviors and how have they been modified and improved and changed in order to basically then change the eyes and underlying structures that provide the visually guided behavior. So the basic conclusion of all I've done in the past couple of decades is that eye evolution is driven by the evolution of visual tasks. So in order to understand that, we have to actually work our way through the animal kingdom a bit. So let's start with a number of different animals and see what we know about visually guided behavior in them. Can anyone recognize what kind of animal this might be? It's not very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Because if you couldn't do this one, you've got no chance of doing it.
Snake. Gecko.
Yeah, it's a gecko. They've got these multiple pupils. But if you look at cats and geckos, really, they use their eyes for much the same purposes. They see each other, they see prey, they see predators, they move around in their environment. Pretty much the same types of visual tasks. Let's continue.
Chameleon.
Absolutely, yes. But again, if you look at the visual tasks, they are not very different from the visual tasks that the other animals are engaged in, even though their eyes look pretty peculiar.
Frog,
yeah, then again, frogs, they actually have much of the visual processing in the retina, less in the brain. But apart from that, they again use their eyes for catching prey. They certainly use them for detecting predators. They see each other. They use their eyes for moving about in their environment. Pretty much the same tasks again.
Fish.
Yeah, it's a fish. Exactly. It's a cod, coral cod, I think it's called. The design of the eye in fish is adapted to underwater use. So it differs a bit from the terrestrial animals, but apart from that, it's a typical vertebrate eye. And it's used again for the typical same visual tasks.
Octopus.
Cuttlefish.
It's not an octopus.
It's a squid.
Cuttlefish.
It's not a cuttlefish. It's not even a cephalopod.
Oh.
It's a vertebrate. Ray. We're still in the vertebrates. We haven't left them yet.
It's
a ray. Someone said that, yeah. Blue spotted ray. You can see the blue spot there. This might be a little bit harder. No, it's not a spider. I'll show you a bit more. It's a mesopelagic fish. Their eyes are modified. They just basically look straight upwards, because when you're living in the mesopelagic world, then you've got downwelling light coming down. It's fairly faint. That's just about all the surface or all the natural light you can get. There are bioluminescent sources in any direction, which might be of interest, but if you want to find animals to eat, you better look up and look for dark silhouettes. So that's what they do. It's a pretty scary world though, because there might be someone below you that you can't see. They look for another silhouette, which is yourself. Now, who's might be the owner of this one? Yeah, now we're actually we've finally left the vertebrates here. This is the owner, actually. It's a humble squid. Their eyes are built all in the sort of general morphology of the eye, the way the eye works. It's based exactly on the same principles as vertebrate eyes. It's a canard eye. The geometry is almost identical to fish eyes. So it's built for use underwater. And squid, octopus, and cuttlefish, they use their eyes for same types of visual tasks as we've seen vertebrates do. No big difference. Yeah, now I can hear lots of you whispering spider, which it is. It's a night active, it's a net-casting spider, Deinopis, which has got these really huge forward-pointing eyes, which it uses for prey capture. It's got actually a bit of division of labor, so it's got other pairs of eyes. There's one pair there, and you can see one eye there. It's actually one side, you can see one eye. It's got four pairs of eyes, altogether eight eyes. So they do basically all the same visual tasks. It's just that they put some of the visual tasks in one type of eye, another visual task in another eye. Altogether, they can do all these visual tasks types of visual tasks that we do. This is another spider, which you can probably see. It's called a crab spider. It's the ones you often see. You see these spiders sitting in flowers, and they're ambush predators. They just wait for flies and things to land on the flower. They try to look like the flower. They also do the same thing with a division of labor, so they've got different pairs of eyes doing different tasks. But altogether, they do all sorts of different tasks. Clearly an insect of some sort, yeah. It's actually one of those horseflies, the annoying things that bite you in summer. They've got these fantastic colours on the eyes. It doesn't actually mean much for the animal inside, because it doesn't mean that they've got multicoloured sunglasses or anything like that. Because when you look out through these corneas, there's actually very little covering the light. So this is actually for the viewer. And it's possible that the viewer is other horseflies, but more likely a kind of camouflage. So they will break up the silhouettes of the eyes. Now that's a weird insect. Has anyone seen any one of those before? It's got quite a number of eyes. It's a mayfly, and it's a male mayfly. They only live for a very short time. They live for about a year or so as larvae in the water, and as adults they live only for 1 or 2 days. They've got a pair of typical insect compound eyes there, and they've got what insects normally also have, 3 pairs of ocelli, which are used for flight stabilization. And then they've got these peculiar large eyes pointing straight up. It's only the males that have got these eyes. Females have got exactly the same equipment, but they're lacking these ones. The males have them for one purpose only. They are for spotting females. So the males fly close to the ground, females fly much higher up, and then when they use these large eyes looking upwards, when they spot a female, they fly up as much as they can and grab the female and mate with her. That's the only purpose of these eyes, single purpose eyes. Although they've got multi-purpose eyes doing all the other visual tasks underneath, except for flight stabilization, which is done by those tasks. So you see the same thing again as you saw in the spiders. There is a division of labor between different types of eyes, but again, altogether they do a whole range of different visual tasks. I don't really know why I put this slide in. It's just maybe because this photo really nicely shows how important vision might be to some animals. If you spend this much energy on building an eye, it's probably a third of the body weight or so, which your eyes. Vision is important to many animals. I think these flies use their eyes for a whole range of different tasks as well. You may not have seen this creature before, but if you've been swimming in a lake, I've heard that people don't generally swim in these lakes, but if you were to swim in these lakes, I'm sure you would be seen by these things. Yeah, it's a water flea. They've got a cyclopic, a single large eye in the front. It's actually fused lateral eyes, which have formed a single eye. And they use this for prey capture. They detect each other. They also see prey and can avoid prey and so on. Or predators. They certainly use their eyes for much the same purposes as we've seen all other animals do before.
Horseshoe crab.
Very good. That's the rest, yeah. Horseshoe crabs have got compound eyes, and they use them they detect each other, they find mates, and they move around and navigate using their compound eyes. So again, much of the same visual tasks as before. So now we're back to our own species again. This is actually a Swedish princess. I was part of it, helped out doing a TV show two years ago, and they insisted that I use this photograph. I wanted a high resolution photograph, a portrait of a person, to illustrate how much different animals see. So they gave me this photo of a Swedish princess. And the resolution of it, at least in my computer, actually it should be, projector should be able to resolve roughly the same. This is the amount of information that a human would see at 1 meter's distance from another human. So that's the amount of detail. If we use this principle, now we can ask questions, how much would actually the other animals see? We can ask, what would a cat see? This is what a cat would see. Did you see the difference? We'll go back to human. So this is what a cat would see 1 meter away from a human. I don't know if you actually see any difference in the back rows there. Actually, cats wouldn't see this because they're not trichromats. So cats would rather see... that was the cat here. Cat color vision. That's our trichromatic, that would be color, dichromatic catfish. I accidentally flicked over to the next one, which is a dragonfly. Dragonflies have got huge eyes, but they're compound eyes. And actually, compound eyes are not as good as camera type eyes. The reason is that there are two things that limit the amount of spatial information and the amount of detail that an eye can see. One is the particle nature of light, the fact that we actually detect individual photons, and photons that arrive randomly. The other is the wave nature of light, diffraction. So if you have small lenses, it means you pick up very few photons, and that limits the amount of detail you can see. It also means that the wave nature of light will make light spread quite a lot, so you actually blur the image if you have small lenses. So if you divide your eye into one little private lens for each pixel, which is what dragonflies do, then it's the ultimately most stupid solution to vision that you can possibly imagine. So even though dragonflies have got large eyes, this is what a dragonfly would see. Not quite as much as a cat, but actually quite a lot worse. The next one will be from a fruit fly. So you can kind of imagine now, what would a fruit fly see? They've got tiny eyes and they're compound eyes. It's a bad solution to vision, and they're also tiny. Eye size is a good determinator of how much you can actually see. The larger the eye is, the better you can see in general. So this is what the fruit fly would see. Now you would possibly conclude that, well, fruit flies can hardly see at all. I actually had an interesting comment once from a Californian optometrist, I think it was, who complained about one of my papers that I talked about vision in jellyfish. I'll get to that later. Because he claimed that according to Californian law, jellyfish were blind. Because there is a limit below a certain resolution, you're legally blind, and jellyfish are legally blind. So I shouldn't talk about vision, it must be called something else. So I think, because fruit flies are probably legally blind as well. But fruit flies actually do pretty well. They use their eyes for it's not useless to be a fruit fly. They can use their eyes to extend their legs just when they land. They can see when the substrate they're landing on is approaching. They can even communicate visually with each other at a couple of body lengths distance. So fruit fly eyes are not useless to fruit flies. They're actually pretty good. Imagine if you put a pair of human eyes on a fruit fly, it wouldn't actually do much good, would it? So, yeah?
Would it be possible that the fruit fly has a refractive error, is very myopic to see where its feet are landing on the twig, and this at 1 meter is just out of focus?
Actually, when you have lenses that size, the depth of focus is basically infinite, so they would have the same resolution at all distances. It's only when you make an eye of a certain size that you start to have the need for accommodation and to focus at different distances.
So what's the Drosophila's resolution at one centimeter or 1 millimeter? How well do they see?
Well, if this is 1 meter away, you can imagine.
I mean, if they're using it for landing, I mean, are they able to see their foot clearly?
No, not clearly. Not clearly in what we would call clearly. But then again, if you ask an eagle if they could talk, that have 2.5 to 3 times higher resolution than we have. If you ask an eagle what is human resolution, they would say, I mean, your vision is blurry. But of course, we know it isn't.
So how did you manipulate these pictures to get these figures?
Oh, I just used simple values of resolution, spatial resolution, or acuity in the different animals. I just blurred the pictures to exactly that amount. So
but
it's fairly
easy. But they did the visual tasks fine. Drosophila will land and take off without any problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So for them, I mean, the spatial difference, I mean, they can tell where they're landing. They don't seem to overshoot.
Yeah. No.
Over,
so. But then again, actually, this is not the complete visual world of a Drosophila. That is a small part of the visual field. Because after all, that is 1 meter away from a human face. Their visual field is 180 degrees or more, actually. So if you want to see the entire visual world of a fruit fly, it would extend over half this room. And there would be lots more detail in it.
So this is just one segment of their compound eye, is that?
Yeah, this would correspond to a segment. The segment that is actually looking at a human face at 1 meter's distance.
So with a thousand or so segments, or I don't know how many segments.
Yeah, they've got about
but
600 facets, so that they have a picture of about 600 pixels.
And is there any increase in resolution by integrating those multiple pixels?
No, you can't really do that. There is 600 pixels. They have to make do with that.
So is it possible that resolution of motion is more important or higher?
Actually, motion is always important in all animals. That's the main visual cue, is motion. Things that don't move.
But we're not looking at motion. We're just looking at form recognition here.
Yeah, at the moment, yeah. You're right.
If we were to look at a fruit fly flying around, we might have a better impression of
it. When we pass it into our own brain, we would actually, we would experience better resolution when it moves, yeah. Probably fruit flies will do as well. Okay, so I think we've already basically answered the question what these eyes are used for, but let's take a more close look at what these eyes are used for. So let's try to divide different types of uses of eyes into some broad general categories. So one of these categories would be high resolution vision, which you use for detect prey and predators, to see your conspecifics, and to communicate visually. All those things require really high resolution. All the animals we've seen do that. So high resolution vision, we could say, is one large category of visually guided behaviors. But if there's high resolution vision, if I've made that distinction, then of course there must be low resolution vision. Nearly all animals with decent eyes, they also have low resolution vision. We have it ourselves. When we move around, we see a flow field moving, which tells us about our own motion in relation to the inanimate world. It tells us about if we're turning, because then the world moves faster on one side than the other, and so on. We use low resolution vision to avoid walking into things. It's only really concerning things that are about the same size as our own bodies. We're not concerned about walking into things the size of a fly. It matters for the fly if they fly into us, but it doesn't matter for us if we walk into the fly. So you'd only really need very low resolution to avoid colliding with obstacles and to determine your own motion in relation to the world. Also, if you want to navigate and in relation to big structures in the world, big skyline changes and so on, then you need very low resolution to do that. Lots of animals that can home and find their burrow and things by extremely low resolution. A handful of pixels up to, say, 100 pixels or so. Extremely low, poorly resolved images. So that's low resolution vision, and basically all animals with something that we would call eyes engage in it. But there are actually other things, that other behaviors that also require information contained in light. And, determination of the direction of the light source is something that many really primitive animals, many larvae of marine animals, they engage in phototaxis. They move towards the light or away from the light. It's useful because if you get too close to the surface, you get into high levels of UV and blue light, which is damaging to them, so they don't want to be too close to the surface. Although they may often want to be reasonably close to the surface because the food is there, they may sometimes they move over to darker places. And so phototaxis is something that a number of really primitive animals use a lot. And in order to do phototaxis, you really don't need any image at all. You just need a single light meter, which is directional. And then if that is put on your body, you can move around and see it, or it's kind of dimmer there. So I want to go to a different place and I go there. You don't need anything more than that. So that's far simpler task than the low resolution ones. So we're getting to simpler and simpler things, and there is a gap, as you can see up here. It must be something even simpler than phototaxis, based on determination of the light source direction. And that is, of course, measuring the amount of light in any direction. So a non-directional measurement of light, which will tell you about, for example, what time of day it is. If you live in the sea, it'll tell you what depth you live in, if you're too deep or too high up. So those are things you can determine by having a non-directional light meter. So this would be four major categories of behaviors that are driven by the information contained in light that the animal can pick up. So we can just put numbers on them, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So these are four major classes of behaviors. And we'll get back to it fairly soon. We'll just conclude that animal groups that can engage in all four of these major classes are these groups. We've got the vertebrates, they can do all four classes. insects and crustaceans are known to also do all four classes. Cephalopods, octopus and squid and cuttlefish, they certainly do all four. And some spiders. These are the four groups in the animal kingdom, but actually the only four groups that can do these four tasks. So what about the rest of the animal kingdom? Let's take a look at the phylogenetic tree. These are all the different phyla of animals, and the ones I've circled with yellow here are the ones that have evolved eyes that can be used for all four types of visual tasks. Doesn't mean that all the other animals are blind. They're certainly not. They've got photoreceptors. Basically, every single one of these phyla have got photoreceptors, so they can sense light. So what do? Let's take a look at some animals in that part. This is an animal that does not do high-resolution vision. You can probably see it's the tentacle of a slug or a snail. Their eyes are not capable. They're not capable of high resolution. They're actually out of focus, totally out of focus. But they can do low resolution vision with them. And it's not an awful lot actually known about them, but that's probably what they do. This is another funny animal. It's another. Seen animals like that before? It's a conch. Conch shells have really remarkably long eye stalks with fantastic eyes on. It looks really like a vertebrate eye. If you put one of these in a fish tank, you can see these enormously long eye stalks. They're just hanging out there. And whatever you try to do outside the fish tank, what kind of signs of waving and jumping? They just sit there. They don't move. They don't respond at all to what you're doing. It seems they've got no visually guided responses at all. No matter what you try, striped gratings that move, maybe they track them. No, they don't. They don't do bloody anything. What do they have them for? Well, it's easily worked out. If you take five of these shells, put them on a nice sandy patch 2 meters deep, intact, and you take another five animals where you've been nasty to them and cut the eyes off. It's really bad, yeah, but. And you wait 20 minutes and you find that the five animals that had their eyes, they all moved in the same direction towards a nice seagrass bit, whereas the other ones that had their eyes removed, they moved randomly in other directions. So they apparently use it for finding a suitable habitat, a place where they want to be. And that seems to be the only visually guided response you can prove that they use their eyes for. So if you stand in front of the fish tank and wave, you're not a suitable habitat. So they completely ignore you. So what about these animals? That looks like blueberries, but it's not.
Scallop.
It's a scallop, yeah. They've got hundreds of these funny eyes along the mantle edge. It's a bit debated what they actually use them for. Clearly they use them for closing the shell when fish approach, because fish like to nibble of these, that mantle tissue there. And, the scallop doesn't like to have that done to them. But they can't just close the shell, they can also actually clap away, they can swim. It's not known if they actually use their eyes to determine where they swim, but for that it's a possibility. Now we're getting to really strange animals. Doesn't even look like eyes, it looks like, I don't know what it looks like. It's actually another clam. It's an arctic clam. They've got along the mantle edge, just as scallops have got these blueberry-like eyes, which contains concave mirrors. These clams, the arctic clams, they've got compound eyes, lensless compound eyes. In the bottom of each of these pits, there is a little photoreceptor. And because it is in the bottom of a pit, it's pointing in a particular direction. So these animals are not really interested in seeing images, but they want photoreceptors that point in small or has narrow angular sensitivities. Because if a fish moves around, it will actually be detected by at least one or a few of these. And if that happens, the clam closes its shell. Now that's a flatworm, that's the front half of a flatworm, and you can see the eyes there. A curved, pigmented thing with a few photoreceptors inside. It doesn't really provide the animal with an awful lot of spatial information. A handful of pixels is about what this animal can divide the world into. But that's good enough for the animal, to, again, to place itself in the right habitat, and that's what they're used for. These pigment pit eyes are certainly not good enough to allow the animal to see other animals of the same species, or not even predators are detected by these eyes. That's a really weird thing. That's actually an eye there. It's a pit eye from a Hydrocoelan jellyfish. It's a shallow pigment pit with a few photoreceptors inside. And the jellyfish uses it to determine its own body orientation. It can measure the depth in the sea, plus it can determine the body orientation. So, because it is a pit, it is a directional photoreceptor. So it'll tell the animal what's up and down in relation to its own body. Not much more than that. Even more strange animals. The upper one here is the larva of a jellyfish, larva of a box jellyfish. It has got, you see these dark things here, they are single cell eyes. Each of those is a single cell, but the animal has got no nervous system. So whatever these things here see, it cannot tell the rest of the body. So how does it work? Well, actually, all of these cells on the surface of the larva contains a little cilium, and when the cilia beat, that is how the animal swims. These ones were dark pigmented, and they are directional photoreceptors, but they also have a cilium, so they can also propel the animal. So they act as rudders. So these ones are controlled by light, and they can actually steer the animal left or right, away from the light or towards the light. So they do it because the same cells are both the sensory organs and the motor output, which drives the animal. So they don't need a nervous system to do this. So that's about as simple as it goes. And that's not even an animal down here, it's a plant. It's a dinoflagellate with a modified chloroplast, which has actually turned into a large lens and a retina-like structure. Amazing things, these. Very little is known about them. More actually should be known, I think. These dinoflagellates, they hunt, it seems, other species of dinoflagellates that do not have eyes. They have chloroplasts instead. And it seems they hunt the other ones and eat them. Now I'm actually going to say a bit more about a particular group of invertebrates, the box jellyfish, which I've studied for about, actually more than 10 years now. The reason I started to work on box jellyfish is that I wanted to pick one of these really primitive animals and ask the question, what do they use their eyes for? In order to find what possibly might be the early types of visual tasks that drove evolution to the first types of eyes. So I picked the box jellyfish because they intrigued me. There were old papers about that they actually had rather advanced eyes. The problem is they've got no brain, really. So how the heck does it work? Box jellyfish have got four of these, they're called ropalia, or sensory clubs, along the sides of the bill. You see one there. If you look closely at it, it looks like that. You can see one large lens eye, a smaller lens eye, and two pairs of lensless eyes. See it in another direction there, the large lens eye and the small lens eye, and the two pairs of lensless eyes. They're all suspended in a stalk, and the stalk is extremely flexible, so even if it hangs like this, and if the animal swims on the side, it doesn't matter, because that structure has exactly the same orientation all the time. Even if the jellyfish swims completely upside down, these structures maintain the correct orientation, which means that there is one eye that is actually always pointing straight up. But as I said, they've got four of these, so they in total they've got 24 eyes. And in each of these structures there is a brain-like ganglion. It's quite about 1,000 to 2,000 neurons. So there is a bit of a brain in here, and these things are connected through a ring nerve. You can faintly see it there. And apart from that, it's a diffuse nerve net. So this is the control electronics of the jellyfish. It's got its sensors, all its sensors on here, and it's communicating through a ring nerve, and that controls the muscles that contract the bell, and the animals can actually steer and swim. And they display a rather advanced behavior. Some of these even have a courtship behavior, although it's not visually guided, but they certainly have a rather elaborate visually guided behavior. as well. They move, they don't collide with obstacles at all. They can find their suitable habitat really easily. This is a small species of box jellyfish from the Caribbean. This is from Puerto Rico in the mangrove swamp. Where you find them among in the or between the prop roots in the mangrove swamp. You never find them in the lagoon. You never find them washed up. They stay in a narrow zone in the mangrove swamp. How can they do that? It turns out they actually use their eyes to do that. What we've found out by looking closely analyzing the eyes on this sensory club, you can see the large lens eye there, the small lens eye, which is always pointing upwards. If you look from the front, you see the large lens eye there and the small lens eye pointing upwards there, the two pairs of lensless eyes. Still don't know much what the two pairs of lensless eyes do, but I think we've solved what the lens eyes actually do. Turns out that the large lens eye is looking for obstacles and makes sure that the animals do not collide with obstacles. So they never swim into the prop roots. But they can't see each other, because what we found out when we did the optics of these animals was that if you have the lens there, the best focus is actually way behind the retina, because that's where the retina is. So these eyes are really poorly focused. Same thing with the eye looking upwards. You can see the retina is over there. The best focus is down there. You've got a pigment layer. There's actually light is stopped there. But the retina is not where the good focus is. So these animals don't see a very sharp image. You may have seen this Gary Larson cartoon, The Last Thing a Fly Ever Sees. I've done the corresponding thing for box jellyfish in our lab. This is the last thing a box jellyfish sees in our lab. This is the total visual field of the box jellyfish, 170 degrees. So they would see me like that if I stick my face really up, basically into the jellyfish almost. That's not very good resolution. I can show you more in detail what it would look like if we take as an input, we take an animated roller coaster ride. So you will see what a box jellyfish sees up here when it goes for a roller coaster ride. I don't think a real box jellyfish has ever experienced this. It's kind of an interesting question what box jellyfish sees when they go on roller coaster rides. So you see the sky patterns here, they're completely gone, they adapt away. We've actually measured electrophysiologically as well. So this is a computer generated model, but we've used optical data and electrophysiological data to be able to mimic what the jellyfish would see. The sky is gone. You see certain fine structures here, they're not visible either. You can look at the sky now when we come up here. Suddenly the sky becomes visible as soon as it moves. So things will have to move, otherwise they're not passed by this system. The only thing that is actually seen are structures that move at a particular speed and have a particular coarseness. If they're too fine, they're filtered out. If they move too fast, they are filtered away. If they move too slowly, they move filtered out as well. So this is a really specific filter that passes only very specific visual information. It is not a poor eye. It's actually a good eye, because this is what they use to avoid colliding with obstacles with. Had these eyes seen finer details, they would make turns for things they shouldn't make turns for. So it's not a poor eye, it's actually a pretty good eye for jellyfish. Do you think the jellyfish would enjoy the ride? I doubt it. Let's take a look at what the upper eye would possibly do. Turns out that the visual field of the upper eye is about 100 degrees. And if you've ever been in a swimming pool and looked up, you will see that there is a circular window where you can see actually through the water surface. Got the water surface here, and you've got 180 degrees of visual field above the water. All that light is refracted into a cone, and that cone has an angle of 97 degrees. And what we found was that the visual field of the upper eye is 100 degrees, very close to 97 degrees. That's kind of intriguing. If you look at the entire visual surrounding of the animal, imagine the animal being inside this sphere. That's seen it up there. And the dashed line here is this window called Snell's window, where you actually look out through the water surface. The red things here are the visual fields of the most peripheral photoreceptors in the upper eye. So it really agrees perfectly with Snell's window, which indicates that this upward pointing eye really is interested in looking through the surface. So what would you see when you look out through the surface? If you live in a mangrove swamp, they actually see the edge of Snell's window, and they see most of Snell's window. If you live in a mangrove swamp, you see mangrove trees, foliage, mangrove canopy. And this is what they would actually see. If you are at the edge or a bit outside the edge, you will see that you're not covered by a mangrove canopy. It's actually a bit to the side. That's what the jellyfish eye would see. Not very much, but you can still see that it's darker over there. And what we found out was that if we put the animals in a place where they can see this with their upper eye, you can actually see the swim tracks there. They want to swim back in that direction. As soon as everything is covered with mangrove canopy, they're happy. They're in the place they want to be. If it looks like that, that's when they're really far out in the lagoon. You can't even see any mangrove trees in any direction. Then they swim like mad in any direction, but they don't know where anymore. So they clearly use their upper eyes to see the edge of the mangrove swamps, and then they know where to go. That actually pulls them in towards the edge of the mangrove swamp. The large eye makes sure they don't get too far in, but then collide with things. So these two eyes puts the animal exactly in the right place, and that's the place where the food is most abundant for them. They don't see the food, but they use these two eyes to put them in the place where food is most abundant. So that's certainly a low-resolution visual task. They don't do high-resolution visual tasks. They do the first, the second, and the third class. They don't do the fourth class of visual tasks. And there is a range of animals that do different, or that don't do the fourth class, but they do other classes. What we can learn from all this is that simple eyes are optimized. They are not imperfect. They're optimized for their tasks. And if you ask the question, if eyes evolved from poor to perfect, which is, if you just asked if that happened, yes, of course, it sounds reasonable. Eyes evolved from poor to perfect. But that's really a misconception. Eyes certainly did not evolve from poor to perfect. Eyes evolved from being perfectly adapted to a few simple visual tasks to being able to perform a huge range of much more complex visual tasks. So that's a better way of understanding eye evolution, I think. So now let's have a look at the requirements for all these visual tasks. So we've made this distinction into four different types of visual tasks. So let's see what kind of requirements they would need from the eyes in order to be able to perform those four different classes. So the non-directional light sensitivity, I've actually taken a larva from it is a sea urchin larva, it is. They haven't got any dark pigment in them. They've got opsins, they've got light-sensitive pigments in them. And they do these non-directional light sensitivity, which basically all animals do, but these animals just do that. So what do you need to do that? Well, you need light-sensitive molecules of some sort, obviously. All animals seem to use the same, or actually not all cases, there are some exceptions, but it's basically always based on vitamin A aldehyde or retinol. That's the light sensitive molecule, and you need a signaling system such that can affect the membrane potential of the cell, which is done via an opsin or a G protein cascade. Those are things you need, but you also need some kind of regeneration mechanism, because otherwise vision would be short-lived. You would use up all your light-sensitive molecules and not see again. So you need a regeneration mechanism. But once you have these three types of molecular mechanisms in place, you can do class one tasks. They really have no conspicuous morphology. These cells that do this are probably very common, but we don't know much about it, because until now there has been no really good way of detecting these cells. Now we can label different types of opsins and where they are and where they are expressed. So now we're starting to discover more and more of these cells that have non-directional light sensitivity. More physically, in physical terms, what would they be needing to do this task? Well, they need to be sensitive in all directions, because if they are sensitive only in a particular direction, they would get very ambiguous measurements of the ambient intensity. Because if you want to use this for measuring the depth in the sea, if you live in the sea, or just determining the time of day or something like that. If you're not interested in how much light is in that direction or that direction, you don't want your measurement to be mixed up with that. So you really want to pick up light equally from all directions. 360 degrees exception of light. You want to have long integration times, because these daily changes in light are not fast. You're not interested in fast changes. You actually should integrate over a very long time. What more, you're not interested in small changes either, because the change between bright sunlight and a starry night is actually more than, that's 8 log units. It's 100 million times difference in intensity. It's a huge difference. So if you want to detect a change in intensity between day and night, you don't need to be very accurate about measuring small changes. And the reason I bring that up is that you actually only need to sample very few photons in order to accurately determine how bright it is. Okay, let's continue and see, look at class two, directionality and body movement that animals use for phototaxis, and possibly for orient the body in relation to the light, using it as optical statocysts. Then clearly you need light shielding structures of some sort. You see a little, another jellyfish larva there with these dark pigment things that are basically intended to block light out from half of the world. So those light shielding structures mean that you're not really picking up light from all directions anymore. About half the world is enough. To pick up light from half the world and occlude the rest, you get down to about 180 degrees and then the system will work. 10 minutes integration time is no good, because these animals move much faster than that. So you need faster photoreceptors. You need faster shutter times, shorter shutter times. So they need to have much higher speed. Half a second integration time is more appropriate for a system like this. And 30% contrast is actually not really good either. You need to be a bit more accurate in determining how bright it is, because the difference in one scene is not 8 log units. It's about 1.5 log units between the darkest parts and the brightest parts in any visual scene. So you need to be more accurate, which means you need to collect more photons in order to get that accuracy. So if you want to have a 10% contrast accuracy, you need to have about 100 photons per sample. So you need more photons, but you get less photons because you cut down the angle and you have a shorter integration time. It seems we're aiming for a little problem here. So let's continue to the next type, low resolution image vision. In order to do that, you need to have an array of different photoreceptors that point in different directions, so you actually have image vision. But you don't need a lot of different pixels. You need a small number of pixels, say 30 pixels, 50 pixels, or something like that. But of course, if you have that many pixels, they can't each cover 180 degrees. You have to cut down on the angle that each pixel collects light over. So you need multiple receptors with smaller angles, and the smaller angles would have to be, say, 10 degrees, 25 degrees, or something like that. That cuts out a large proportion of the light, of course. If you do that, if you have light measurements over a smaller angle and you move around, things will change much faster, so you need to cut down on the time as well. Half a second is not, that's too long an integration time, so let's put that down to 0.1 of a second. You have even less light now, but you actually need more light, because now you're interested in detecting structures against the background, and the contrast may be even lower than 10%, so let's say 3%. Contrast, and that means that you actually would need 1,000 photons in order to be able, for each sample, in order to be able to discriminate contrast of as low as 3%. So you need more photons, but you get less photons. That is a problem. But let's continue to the third class of visual tasks and see what happens there. High resolution image vision, the only main difference between low resolution and high resolution is really the resolution. So you need extremely small visual angles, down to 0.1 of a degree or something like that. Some animals make do with 1 degree, 1.5 degree, and so, and can do high resolution tasks, but we've got down to 60th of a degree in human vision. So you get extremely small angles. If you have extremely small angles, the integration time needs to be cut a bit further, because things otherwise will change too fast and you will get motion blur. The contrast can stay the same, but we now have a clearly a severe problem. We pick up very few photons, but we need an awful lot of photons. So let's see, we can actually now calculate what kind of intensity you would need. Let's say you have a single photoreceptor cell. Right, this is just summarizing what we've said before. So these are all the parameters, the values we've got here. We can use these values and put them in an equation and ask the question, how much light would we need in the environment in order to be able to do the task? Because we know how many photons we need and we know how many we will actually pick up. So let's do that calculation. For a single cell that has photopigment or light-sensitive pigment in one membrane only, that's a single layer of densely packed opsin molecules. And the equation is as simple as that. So we just use that equation and then put that into the range of natural intensities in the world. So you've got this intensity scale here on a log scale. At bright sunlight, we have about 10 to the power of 20 photons per square meter per sphere radian, something like that. It's a solid angle per second. That's the amount of photons that we are bombarded by in bright sunlight. On a cloudy day, it's about 1 to 2 log units less. At night, in a starry night, it's about 8 log units less, or 100 million times less. Moonlight is only 1 million times less. The total range within any scene, as I said before, is about 1.5 log units. So what happens at dusk and dawn is that this 1.5 log units is just sliding down the intensity scale and landing down here instead. It's always about the same range in intensity between the brightest and dimmest part in a scene. So this is the kind of intensity scale over which eyes will have to operate. And we know how many photons we need to, how many photons that are available. Now we can use the equation we had over there to calculate how far down on this scale we can actually get with the kind of parameters we just derived. So let's do that. So we have the different classes here, class 1, class 2, class 3, class 4, high resolution, low resolution, phototaxis, and non-visual tasks. So let's do the calculation for the non-visual tasks for this little cell. It turns out it works pretty well. It works down to those intensities, night intensities, actually lower than night intensities. So that's fine. You can have a single cell with some photopigment in the membrane, and you can do non-visual tasks. You can do these non-directional sensitivity tasks pretty well. No problem at all. So let's make the same calculation for class 2 tasks then. Turns out we end up there, mid dusk and dawn intensities. At other intensities, it's simply not enough light on this planet to allow you to do that task with that single cell. So what about low resolution tasks then? Well, then as we can expect, we really end up in trouble. We can discriminate the almost highest intensities from the very highest intensities, but nothing more. We're basically blind. And what about the high resolution tasks that we normally experience as vision? Turns out it's up there. It's actually 5 log units, 100,000 times more light than bright daylight is necessary in order to do high resolution tasks. So it seems there must be something wrong with these calculations, because we can do high resolution tasks. So what's wrong in the equation? There must be something. Well, we have assumed, let's take a look at the equation. We have assumed a single cell with just photopigment in one membrane. That membrane, when light passes through it actually picks up only 0.02% of the light. All the rest remains unabsorbed. So a single layer of membrane, even if you pack it tightly with rhodopsin molecules, is not really very good at detecting light. There is a good remedy though. Just fold the membrane and continue to do it. Fold it and fold it and fold it until you get a huge stack of membrane. If you do that, you can actually absorb 80-90% of the light. So you gain a tremendous amount of sensitivity if you do that. And that is exactly what we see in photoreceptors of animals. That is why we see these stacks of cilia, discs on the cilia in the vertebrate rods, and cones for that matter too. In insects, you have microvilli instead of forming rhabdoms. Yet another way of just folding the membrane to get higher sensitivity. What does it do on the calculations here? Because that can easily be calculated. And it turns out that that is how far it will take us. So it'll actually rescue the low resolution tasks, at least take them into mid-dusk. What will it do to the high resolution tasks? It'll take us a bit closer to seeing something, but not. We're still about 2 log units away. So we need to do something more. There's something more missing, yeah? Yep, so let's take a look at the equation again. Is there something else we can fiddle with? Minimum light intensity is what we're calculating. Minimum photon sample, well, that is determined by the physics of light. We can't do anything about that. The solid angle of sensitivity, that's what really we have to, if we want to do high resolution tasks, we have to have small angles, so we can't fiddle with that. The sensitive area, though, that's something we can deal with, because we have assumed that we have a small cell, some less than 10 micrometer across. That's a very small area. We can fix that if we put a lens on top of it. Then it's not the area of the cell, it's the area of the lens instead. And lenses can be, of course, huge compared to the cells. So that will give us a dramatic increase in sensitivity. So if we put that into our calculations here, let's see what happens. It actually brings us all the way down there. And of course, with these calculations, it's not such that you can see something there and then you're totally blind, just a few photons less. It's not like that. You gradually lose vision. And you can, of course, also tweak with these values. You can say that, well, maybe I don't need to have quite as short integration times. I can extend the integration times a bit. I can live with having slightly worse resolution. I can live with not seeing quite as high or quite as low contrast. See? These are all a bit fuzzy, and we can even calculate how fuzzy they are, and that is, it's some, roughly something like that on a log scale. Which means that if you were to put lenses on the low resolution tasks, you would cover all intensities available on Earth. If you put the membrane stacking or folding onto the class 2 tasks, the phototaxis things, you make that cover everything as well. And that is actually the lesson that comes out of all this. Because this is a way of showing the key steps in eye evolution, the important things in eye evolution that has allowed evolution from the lowest, simplest behaviors to the most advanced behaviors, which we can summarize really like this. You can do the simple class 1 non-directional light detection things. If you just have a chromophore, something that detects light, you have a signaling system and you have regeneration. So if that has evolved first, then you could do the non-directional tasks and you have task complexity on that axis. If you add screening pigment, something that blocks light, then you can make the step from non-directional tasks to directional tasks. You can do them reasonably well, but you can actually do them better if you start to fold your membrane, because then you can do the directional tasks over a wider range of intensities. And if you start to do that, then it means that you can also allow yourself to change from from directional light sensitivity class 2 tasks to low resolution tasks. So the introduction of membrane folding will allow you to go to the next class of visual tasks. You can perform that a little bit better actually at lower intensities if you introduce a lens. And once you introduce a lens, that allows you to go to the final and highest class of visual tasks. So you can see how membrane folding and the introduction of lenses has really made these huge steps from one type of visual tasks to the next. And all these things, of course, are true for the intensities on the planet Earth. God knows what it's like on any other planet in the universe where the star shines much more brightly or in a dimmer place. Eye evolution would not be the same as it has been on Earth. So thank you for listening. Questions?
Yeah. So when you first introduced the level 4, the high resolution, you said there were a couple different groups of animals that were capable of that.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned, you know, cephalopods, certain arthropods, and vertebrates, of course. And
yeah.
So arthropods would include insect compound eyes.
Yeah.
And then you went on to tell us that jellyfish actually do not make the cut, that they only do level 1, 2, and 3.
Yes.
But when you showed us the pictures of what it might look like for a Drosophila to see that face, it was completely blurry. And yet when you showed us the jellyfish on the roller coaster, it looked better.
Yeah.
So how do you explain that difference between high res and low res?
That's the resolution of a Drosophila is about 6 degrees. The resolution of the jellyfish is about 10 to 12 degrees, and the resolution of the jellyfish is actually worse. It just looks the other way around, because the resolution of the jellyfish was the 470 degrees of visual field. But when I showed the resolution of the Drosophila, it was a small part of the visual field.
So
if you take that and magnify that, it looks more blurry, so that's three. Okay? Yep.
I wonder how difficult the particular transitions were you showed in your last slide, and in particular, how many independent evolutionary events were associated with each of those transitions.
You mean this one?
Yes.
Yeah?
If that's an index, that is how many times it happened. If you knew the number of taxa that have reached, say, class 2, and the number of those, how many years? And how many events took them to class 3?
Well, clearly, class 1 is done by basically all phyla.
Right.
But it also seems that photosensitivity using opsins, that has evolved once only.
But it said that camera eyes have evolved at least, what is it, 5 times or 11 times?
Something like that, yeah. Something like that.
If you map what Khan's asking onto your phylogeny,
yeah, actually, more like something like that.
Yeah.
There you can see that you've got the class 4 tasks in these places. Over there, that's the cephalopods, the two places in arthropods, and that's us over there. That's class 4 tasks. It would be possible to map class 3 tasks in this as well. You would then find probably that class 3 tasks have actually evolved in these special, the gray bubbles, it would be class 3 tasks.
And you could do sister clade analysis if you could find clades that did not have stage 3 to stage 4 transition.
Yeah, and I'm actually working on this, but it's not quite ready yet. But exactly what you tried to,
So that would tell us how much the improvement of vision contributed to diversification.
Exactly, you can say that, yeah. Sure. Okay.
How can we predict a certain animal has a vision, a unique vision or not? Can we predict based on the membrane folding or whether it has lens?
How much? Yeah, to a certain extent you can do that, because you can say if they haven't got a lens, they certainly, they can't do higher resolution tasks. That's impossible to do without a lens on this planet. You can't do low resolution tasks unless you have membrane folding. So animals that don't fold their membrane, there are not many of them, but there are some. So you can clearly determine, it actually agrees with, not the calculations agrees with reality, clearly. If that is an answer to your question, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess I will ask, what really sets apart, what elements apart the image vision animals and non-image animals.
Yeah, okay, that's going from directional light sensitivity to go back. I mean, going from from directional light sensitivity to low resolution vision. That's when you actually introduce pictorial information or spatial information. Going from there to there. Yeah. You need an array of photoreceptors to do that. That's actually one thing I could have put into the diagram. You need more than one photoreceptor, and they should point in different directions. Yeah?
Has anybody evolved a system of scanning, like a raster scanning? I know the jellyfish on, or whatever it was, on a roller coaster doing a little of that.
Yeah. There are a few animal groups, not many, but there are some gastropod mollusks that have a limb, that they actually scan like that.
Ah.
So they pick up spatial information in a time sequence.
And they swing a sensor around?
Yeah, they do. They have eyes. It looks like camera type eyes with a large spherical lens, and they actually go like that all the time. And they scan off the world with a minimum number of photoreceptors. So
I see.
The good thing with it is that it uses up less neurons. You don't need a huge brain to do it.
But you need a good temporal resolution.
Yeah, you need a good temporal resolution. So you actually have to sacrifice that. You need to have reasonably fast photoreceptors in order to do that. Apart from that, it's only really mantis shrimps. They do a bit of that. They have these eye movements. They have a band across their compound eyes with color vision, and they scan this band across the world like that all the time, kind of coloring the world. That's kind of scanning as well. Apart from that, it's not. Yeah, there is another case with a small copepod crustacean, which is scanning in one dimension only. It has a point-like photoreceptor that only measures in one direction, and it scans like this all the time. So it creates a linear type of vision. Yep.
How massive is the class zero group?
But
the ones who have no visual.
Oops. Class zero animals that have no vision, no light sensitivity
right.
at all.
Right. Does it exist?
There are animals that do it. Sponges, for example. They don't have any opsins. They have got no light sensitivity, so they don't respond to light.
So is there a relatively small group that have no light sensitivity?
Yeah. If you're mobile, if you move around in the world, it seems that's something you can evolve if you can respond to light. If you can't respond to light, then moving around in the world you'll be outcompeted by other animals that can respond to light. Yeah.
Again, what about snakes and heath? Is there any animal that they sort of look?
You mean the pit organ of snakes?
Yeah. Is there any animal that would build up an image from a pit organ that could scan? Do they? Anybody scan anything with a pit organ?
With a pit organ, no, not as far as I know. No. All scanning eyes have proper optics of some sort.
With light photons.
Yeah.
What about like wavelengths of light? You know that for resolution of images, how does that impact on your formulating?
Well, the wavelength band that eyes use goes from say 350 nanometers ultraviolet up to 700, a little bit higher than us, but not much. That is the band where there is plenty of light on Earth, and if you go to lower wavelengths, it turns out that nearly everything absorbs in the lower wavelengths, unless you go to really very short wavelengths where things start to get transparent again. If you go to longer wavelengths, nearly nothing absorbs anything. So it's really in this band between 350 to 700 nanometers where you've got differential absorption, where certain things absorb and other things don't. So that's where you get structure in the world. If you take an image intensifier and put an infrared filter on it and go around and look at the world in short ultraviolet, you get really depressed because it looks boring. It's all black already. Except for the sky, which is bright, and there's not even any clouds because they have the same intensity as the sky. If you put on an infrared filter and look at the infrared world, everything is bright. It looks like snowy days, but it looks really, you're happy. But you don't see a lot of structure because everything is bright. So that wavelength band is really the useful band where there is lots of information because different things absorb differently.
Great, well thank you so much.